I'm playing a car at a Disney movie now.
Don't put that on the podcast.
Fly me to the moon. Let me play among the stars. And let me see what spring is like on a Jupiter.
I'm sorry. Hello, citizens of Earth, and welcome to the second episode of our still totally currently unnamed podcast. I am hosting this week. I'm Zach, and as always, we are joined by David.
Hi, everyone.
Oh, God, I hate you so much. And we're also joined by Dan.
Hello, everyone.
So this week, I got to choose the actual theme, and I picked it out of a news article I found first in the National Post with a bit more of an elaborate exclusive article and actually an amazing video clip on Popular Mechanics. And it is called NASA Will Test Balloon-Like Space Homes That Could One Day House Astronauts on Mars. So the actual point of this article is to talk about the alternative space housing, unsurprisingly, because right now we're using what's called a tin can kind of structure, where it's actually this large, cumbersome structure that is the exact size that it's going to end up being while you bring it up. It's heavy, it's cumbersome, it takes up a lot of space, and is predominantly the hardest part about it is trying to actually bring it up into space.
David Bowie sang about that.
Yeah, he did.
Is that the Ziggy Stardust song?
Nah, Space Odyssey.
Space Odyssey.
Talks about living in a tin can.
So NASA is working in conjunction with the commercial space company Bigelow Aerospace, and together they signed a $17.8 million deal to test out an inflatable, bouncy castle-esque space house.
Sounds sexy.
And it's called The Beam, and is no longer sexy because it is actually called the Bigelow Expandable Activity Module.
I reckon that's not the only thing he calls the Bigelow Expandable Activity Module.
Actually, now that I think about it, I really question how much activity activity can go on in that module, with how small we actually know it is now. But first, the major advantage.
There's no slight against Robert Bigelow.
Yeah, it's the shape, it's the density. I think I don't think it matters the actual size. So the actual major advantage of using these inflatable collapsible is that you can transport them much more easily, and you can also get a lot more space out of them. So these things pack into the 17-foot tube. It's not really a tube, though. It's an actual giant cylinder, which could probably be a room in itself. And they actually expand by using air from, like, the oxygen and air supply on the International Space Station.
That doesn't seem sensible.
Yeah.
No.
Well,
you don't want too many of these things out there at any one
time. You got to do what you got to do. And
do we know what the circumference of this tube is?
No. So originally I thought it was, like, a long, narrow tube. Like, you know, that tube, you know, the word tube, it would suggest.
Like those candies coming.
If you look at the Popular Mechanics website, they have like this mock-up CGI image of how the International Space Station is going to attach this to, or going to attach it with its robotic arm. And if you actually look at it, yeah, it's like this giant, more of a disc than a tube. So together, NASA and Bigelow Aerospace are actually doing a test. And in 2015, they're going to send up one of these modules and monitor it over 2 years to see whether or not it protects the astronauts. Whether or not they can actually use it for that long, if it's got any longevity in it. And it is a 52 square or cubic foot module, which sounds really big.
Yeah. That's only, off the top of my head, I think I calculate 1.47 cubic meters, I think.
1.473.
Yeah. If I'm doing the math right. Yeah.
That is literally the only reason we asked you to join us on this podcast. So I looked into a bit more about Robert Bigelow, who's the actual owner of, unsurprisingly, Bigelow Aerospace and the developer of the Bigelow Expandable Activity Module. He actually, 13 years ago, he actually took the design for the inflatable modules from NASA. So NASA produced them all the way to the prototype stage, then canceled the project. And so Bigelow licensed it. He actually bought the engineers that worked on it, or hired them, sorry. And then ended up, now he's selling the exact same technology back to NASA 13 years later.
Oh.
Sounds
business.
Like a good investment plan to me. How did he make all his money, this guy?
So, yeah, so Robert...
His wife won an Oscar for The Hurt Locker.
Oh, hilarious. Hilarious.
Robert Bigelow is a real estate giant, and he also owns a hotel chain, and that's how he amassed all of his money. And he always has wanted... He's had a lot of interest in space, so it's kind of been like a boyhood fantasy of his, but it's really this wonderful... I said boyhood fantasy? Is that right?
Yeah, that's right.
It is. It just still
it
sounds
does sound
weird.
Really terrifying, doesn't it? But anyways... There's actually some kind of hidden reasons as to why he's doing this test with NASA in 2015, and that's because in 2016 he wants to send up his very own space station for low Earth orbit called Space Station Alpha, and not Space Station Bigelow.
Well, I think he's only doing this, so I assume this is for space tourism, right?
Yeah.
He is a real estate giant.
So literally he wants to go, I guess, even though it's supposed to be a 2-year test, he's literally going to just wait 1 year of this 2-year test Because in 2016, he's hoping to send up Space Station Alpha, and it will just be comprised entirely of two of his activity modules that are much larger. Like, I think they're a couple hundred cubic meters each.
Okay. So walking around room, anyway.
Yeah, exactly. And, you know, room for, like, other things, like the things that keep you alive in space. And so, ultimately, he's hoping to actually have this as a potential tourism. Mm-hmm. He hopes to lease it out to companies.
And I imagine he's building this up so he can have, like, sexy space adventures in Robert Bigelow's Space Gigolo, right? Yes. This is where this is heading.
Wait, I knew that was going to come out eventually.
This is literally the worst setup for that trilogy, though. But, like, gotta have my trilogy on lock. Gotta know what happens to Deuce. And for a cool $26.25 million, or as Robert Bigelow puts it, $26 million and change, you can have a space vacation. So this is supposed to be for governments, and it is. He has explicitly said that it will be for rich people too, if they want to.
Richard Branson went up into space recently. I think Richard Branson's up in space, maybe now. Or he was, anyway.
Yeah, you see him. You know when it gets dark, he's a giant white thing in the sky.
Well, it's nice to know that it's not just for governments, but it's also for rich people as well.
Yeah, it's always...
There's possibly the least reassuring statement ever about...
Yeah, well, if there's anything I like hearing... I just like hearing from people who think that $2,500,000 is change. I just want to know their opinions on the world.
Or outside the world, for that matter.
So this was the impetus for this week's theme. And this week's theme, just broadly stated, is living in space. So we're going to take a quick break, but then we are going to come back... And hear from Dan. Dan's going to give you a little sizzler teaser.
Aliens. Aliens today.
Aliens. Good teaser. So we'll be back with aliens. Aliens. We're going to talk about aliens. And I think it's going to be a long, long time. Touchdown brings me round again to find. I'm not the man they think I am at home.
So I wanted to talk about aliens today. Mm-hmm. Aliens and extraterrestrials out there. I wanted to talk about the possibility of life outside Earth existing. So there are 200 to 400 billion stars in the Milky Way, or 70 sextillion estimated stars in our universe.
That's disgusting. I don't see, why can't there just be a number?
70 sextillion. 7 times 10 to the 22nd number of stars estimated in our universe. And they say that our sun is a very young star, and that most of these stars, the 70 sextillion... are much older, that they're billions of years older than our star, and that most of these stars probably do have Earth-like planets. Earth-like planets that might be possible to develop life much like ours.
Just to point out, like, Earth-like, Venus counts as an Earth-like planet, doesn't it?
That's true.
Yeah, and there's all those people that live on that.
Yeah, that's true.
Oh.
The Not idea really. Is supposed to be that on some of these Earth-like planets, there's the chance that civilization has developed. And so there's a program that's run out of Harvard University and UC Berkeley and some other research institutes. It's called SETI, S-E-T-I, the Search for Extraterrestrial Intelligence. And it searches for contact signals from alien life. It uses optical signals or radio signals or pulses from electromagnetic radiation, things like that, to see if aliens are trying to contact us. And you would think with all these stars in the galaxy and the universe and all these likely planets developing that there'd be some chance, just through random chance, of another planet out there existing, developing intelligent life and trying to contact us this way. But no such sign has existed from SETI. SETI hasn't ever found any signal from an alien life form trying to contact us. So there's that.
I always thought it'd be funny if it was like, because we just send out like pulses. Mm. Assuming that like whatever receives just like this pulse is like, oh, this is clearly some kind of extraterrestrial intelligence trying to contact
when
us.
When they had in the book and in the film Contact that was written by Carl Sagan, who set up SETI, is the pulses that they received back were like prime numbers. Yeah, and they're just like, ooh, this is obviously extraterrestrial intelligence because they know about math.
And I was reading that they're actually set to the timing of an atomic clock. They're regularly pulsed.
Mm.
So anyway, there could be that.
I like that idea, though, because it's like, this pulse to a completely naturally occurring thing.
Maybe.
There's no way it's probably just a naturally occurring thing.
But they might just be like, oh, no, we're hearing another set of very well-timed interval bursts from Earth. Those people are obviously so pedantic that we don't want to get anywhere near involved with them. They're just like, they're the kind of people that go, oh, well, I thought we were meeting at 17 past 2. It is now 20 past 2. What the hell?
Who meets at 17 past 2? Anyway, that brings up a question.
This is why I'm alone.
He's got your number.
Anyway, so there's something called the Fermi paradox. It was a scientist named Enrico Fermi who was working at NASA or someplace like this. And he was talking to his scientist friends, and he did the calculations in his head. And he came up with the number that, with so many stars in the galaxy, that we should have been contacted by now. And he famously asked his friends. It sounded like, actually, when you read the recap, his friends went off and talked about something else, and he just stood there for a while thinking about this, and then he just blurted out, "Where is everybody?" And so that's a famous question by Enrico Fermi. Where is everybody? Where are the aliens? Where? How come we haven't received any contact
from
them?
Hold on a second. Are you saying that he looked at all the numbers and calculated the probability?
Yeah.
Oh, so if we ever got some kind of signals coming in, it's probably not aliens because the odds are so great against it.
That's right. Yeah. That's not right at all.
No, that's not what.
You should have listened to our first podcast.
Yeah. Throwback.
If you don't know what Zach's talking about, you should really check out episode 1, where we talk about blood doping and blood doping tests.
And I think the Fermi equation is less to do with the probability as it is to do with estimating the number of alien intelligences there are in the galaxy or the universe or whatever. And I think it was just that there should be loads of them is the outcome. No, that's a Drake equation. Sorry, the Drake equation
that's
comes
right
up with that.
So yeah, I looked up the theories behind this, and I'm going to simplify them a lot. Don't think that this is the be-all and all of these theories, and there's tons of theories I'm not going to touch on. But I'm going to simplify a few of them. First off, there's a theory that's we overestimate the probability that intelligent life forms on other planets. So some evolutionary psychologists, biologists propose that human intelligence isn't necessarily a goal of evolution. There's no goal of evolution. It just sort of naturally
isn't really
happens.
Targeted.
No,
evolution isn't really goal directed.
Yeah. Right. And so one of the assumptions based on that Fermi based this on is that these other Earth-like planets will evolve, or life will evolve the same way, and that life will evolve in that whatever species out there will have to develop intelligence over time to exist. But that's not necessarily the case.
No, not at all. If you think about it now, there's plenty of species you would consider low in some of our intelligence measures that we think are vital to our survival. But they seem to get by just fine.
But also, it's based in the phrase intelligence, which is a horrible word, around human-like intelligence. Especially human-like intelligence that results in the construction of radio telescopes. And it's just like, you could have something that works very well in its environment, does very well, might be even ends up in something like culture or technology that never gets to the stage of radio telescopes, or even not where the radio telescopes is a stage. But it just doesn't occur to them because it's different.
Yeah, it's a simple thing of we don't really understand what intelligence is still, so it's really hard to say that, use it as some kind of classifying.
As a zoologist, we no longer think about higher and lower levels of intelligence, but more that it's all the endpoints of the evolutionary tree. So it's differences, rather than humans are at the top and everything else is lower down on rungs.
I think it's just a problem with this.
Yeah,
that's true. So that's what Jeffrey Miller, the evolutionary biologist, and Steven Pinker said the same thing. Mm. So maybe they should have gotten in touch with this Fermi. But Enrico Fermi was his name.
Mess him up.
So evolution doesn't quite work that way. But that brings up what they call the rare Earth hypothesis, in that Earth would be the only planet in the entire galaxy, in the entire universe, could develop such forms of intelligence. So do you think that it's possible? What would you estimate the probability was that intelligence as we would know it could develop somewhere else?
I imagine, if you want to talk about, if you're talking about, something absolutely parallel to Earth, the probability of so many different things happening is just stacks up constantly, right?
If we are talking about technology.
Yeah, are we talking about something that can communicate with other planets? Like, are you talking about something that we could actually potentially hear from?
Well, that's a great segment into what I'm going to say next, actually. Way to go, Zach. So, one restraint is that not only if there are forms of intelligence out there, as we would call intelligent, we might not be able to communicate with them anyway. And they might be so slow in their communication or so fast in their communication that sending out a message would just come to us as background noise.
Well, and even beyond that, like how they actually would interpret.
Communicate. They might not communicate through radios or optical
signals. Not necessarily just a problem with how fast or
but
slow.
Also, I mean, if we had, surely the time that it would take, because these messages travel at the speed of light,
mm-hmm.
That by the time that you've sent a message, let's say, and it's been received, and they've sent one back, the nearest, I don't know, you might have this information, Dan, but the nearest star system to us is still quite a long way away in light years. Yep. And any the probability that that is going to be the one that has, or one of the ones that has the radio telescopes that's capable of detecting and responding is probably quite unlikely.
It's true.
So it's still going to be hundreds of, maybe thousands of years even before anything would be picked up.
Probably. Yeah, I think SETI is working on the assumption that since most of these stars are much older than ours, then these species would have, or are phylogenetically a lot older than ours. Not phylogenetically, I suppose.
Just chronologically.
Just older, yeah. Chronologically a lot older than ours. And so they probably would have sent out a signal a long, long time ago.
Yeah.
And probably in a much more technologically advanced way. And they're wondering why we didn't get those yet. But it's if they do exist, it's probable that they don't have the right to communication, or we don't have the right to communicate communication devices. And we couldn't pick those up.
So it's more like detection rather than communication.
That's right, yep. Yep. So those are some conventional explanations behind why we don't hear from aliens. But I find it more fun to talk about speculation. So Sagan actually argues that if intelligent life would exist elsewhere in the universe, that it's the nature of intelligent life, and I guess, again, he's using intelligent as you would talk about humans, the nature of intelligent life is to destroy itself. So if you look at humans and you look at our planet, it's
we're
no
on,
secret
we're
that
well on track.
Yeah, we're sinking our planet through climate change and a whole bunch of nuclear warfare, things like this. Sagan argues that it's possible that all intelligent forms of life just sort of develop some tendency to destroy itself, and so that any other form of life that was like us probably has killed itself off by
now. I think the actual quote is that intelligent life develops to post a picture of your ex with her new boyfriend on your Facebook feed, and there's no dislike button. Carl Sagan.
That's true.
Yeah, that is true. That is what Carl Sagan said. But back in Carl Sagan's day, Facebook was merely a corkboard in the hall that he used to write his how he was feeling at that moment on.
Another Carl Sagan quote, disdain is timeless.
But there's other ones in which people have said kind of like the reverse of that almost. The inverse of it, in which it's if aliens were sufficiently advanced to come and visit us, they must be benign because they must have overcome this desire to destroy themselves in order to have lasted long enough to visit us. Which suggests that these people don't know very much about kin selection.
Mm, and on that point, I was going to point out that a lot of the pros in the sort of field seem to have the idea that if a life form could come and visit us on Earth, they would probably come to destroy us.
Yeah.
So they say that any intelligent species that's sort of conquered its planet, much like us, must be some sort of super predator, much like us. And they think that, much like us, if we went off into space, much of our space exploration now is looking for places to stay after Earth is gone.
Mm.
And if that's true of other places, they might be looking into Earth to wipe us out.
Just like in the Avengers.
And in Independence Day.
Yeah.
Sorry, wait. I'm sorry, I'm caught up on me going out on a Friday night and now telling people I am a super predator.
Well, we are. We're the super predator of the planet. Probably the only super predator this planet's ever seen. So what's that?
Assuming that's because the dinosaurs that did that kind of all left, right? They left the other dinosaurs behind.
That's how all the dinosaurs died, right?
Yeah. Super predators.
they
managed to build. They built a tractor beam, which I just found out has recently been made to exist.
Yeah, I read that.
The asteroid in.
Wait, so the asteroid's the super predator?
Yes, asteroids are the ultimate predator of the galaxy.
Oh, they're ultimate. They're like holographic.
Yeah, because exactly, they might be, if they've got past the stage of trying to destroy themselves, they might be something. This is brilliant levels of speculation, but more like a hive in which they're all invested very heavily in each other's survival, in their own evolutionary fitness, it were, in which case they may well get on very well with each other, but that doesn't mean they'll get on well with us.
No. And in fact, that was the premise, if you guys think about it, of Independence Day.
Mm.
That race had a queen and a mothership.
Documentary.
It sent out little, reconnaissance ships or whatever it was to come to Earth, and they set up over New York and LA. But there was one big hive out there, and then Jeff Goldblum and Will Smith went and wiped them out.
Yeah,
but they were moving the
virus on an Apple Mac.
That's right.
Yeah.
A compatible virus.
Yeah.
But they were, if you remember the quote, they were looking for, or they're going from planet to planet consuming their resources and then moving on. And that's actually very much what it sounds like. Experts in the field, if you can call them that, speculate that these aliens that would move from planet to planet would do. Just sort of boot or use up resources and move on. And then I think if you were to predict what humans would do, if we had the capability to go from planet to planet, that's pretty much what we'd do.
We would make Big Macs and eat them.
That's true, too.
I need better sneakers and Big Macs.
Exactly. And the way the way that we have, at least in the past, treated the planet would suggest that even if the aliens came here, we would like to think that they're going like, oh, look, enlightened, intelligent human beings with the capabilities for rational discourse. But they must just think like, oh, no, there's some kind of smelly monkey creatures on this
planet. Have you tried these Big Macs?
We could be so high above them that we would be naught but an ant to their boot.
Going back to McDonald's, the first McDonald's on Mars, I can already see it. It'll be the Golden Arches and then ARS.
Oh, it would as well.
Yeah.
McRs.
And it would be full of beans.
They wouldn't have the C. The McMars burger. Anyway, so there's that. And then there's a hypothesis. I won't go into great detail about any of these, but I like this hypothesis the best. This is the zoo hypothesis.
Yay.
And a lot of people are behind this, too, and they think that's I can't speculate on their credibility, but they speculate that alien races exist very close to our planet, and they know that we're here, and they're watching us right now, and they're watching, and they're seeing how life on Earth develops, and how we, mostly us as the human species, develop, and how we interact with our planet.
Yeah.
So like a zoo. And so they're watching us much like we would watch a nature documentary. And the documentarians, they're off in the distance and they're watching animals, but they're not interfering. They're not supposed to interrupt anything, no matter how sad the case may be.
Yeah, they live in the moon. I saw the Truman Show.
Clangers.
The Truman Show.
No. Ed Harris is living in the moon.
Do you guys know Clangers?
No.
They're like pink, like aardvarks that live on the moon and consume soup.
Don't know that one.
I'm going to have to take your word on it and assume you're not just making up all of this, but I really, on my deepest insides, wish you were making it up all of this.
And others say that aliens watching us know that it would be dangerous to communicate with us because we might go and attack anything that visited our planet.
Or we might be the equivalent of a dark planet that's off limits to the rest of the...
Yeah, that's exactly what this zoo hypothesis is stating.
There's a colony
of other aliens.
When you said that this has got a lot of supporters,
well.
How many of these supporters are part of the physics or biology community, and how many of them are on the internet?
No, it's funny that you should mention that. So I looked into the sources.
Are there a lot of physicists and biologists not on the internet these days?
No, but they also have offices where they study things and write things in journals.
Like, yeah, that's their
rather than like alien fan number one's blog, they live among us.
But the more you look into it, the more you find that, I mean, because these theories are so far out there and there's so little evidence to support anything, that you have physicists, astrobiologists, evolutionary psychologists, well, not even biologists, I suppose. There are a lot of people talking about this, and they do have a scientific background, but they have no knowledge, no theories to support anything. So they're just sort of bickering out there.
I feel like it's kind of a cool topic, though, because it's because so little is known that you can just take assumptions for all the boring parts and then just be like, I'm just going to deal with the alien part.
But I do
Let's assume there's aliens.
Step one. Just to kind of throw this out here, this is specifically talking about, I don't want to use the word human-like, but kind of intelligent enough to build a radio telescope. Aliens, right?
Yes, yeah.
So what about alien life that is not like that?
So that's another point. So many Earth-like planets might exist, but it took... Earth has been here for about 4.6 billion years, and for 3.5 billion years, you only had prokaryotic cells.
Mm-hmm.
And it was only in the last billion and a half years that you had eukaryotic cells develop.
Yeah.
And so even if you take that ratio of time and apply that to other Earth-like planets... there's a very good shot that there are many planets out there that are still developing prokaryotic life.
We should say that prokaryotic cells are cells that don't actually have defined organelles on the inside, so they don't have internal cell compartments, whereas a eukaryotic cell does and has a nucleus.
It's actually thought that there's now fairly good evidence that eukaryotic cells came about originally by prokaryotic cells consuming one another, and that formed the internal organelles. It has been thought that because of that, the probability of eukaryotic cells is something that just is a matter of time.
Yeah, exactly. And so, but I mean, it just, in terms of the space-time not continuum, that's cliche, but in terms of a planet development, many planets are out there still in the prokaryotic stage, or what would be their analog of the prokaryotic stage. But what I like about this is that you can talk about aliens, and you have scientists and people in the scientific community talking about aliens. If you talk about Gigantopithecus up in the forests of the northwest U.S., or if you talk about plesiosaurs in the locks of Loch Ness, then people give you look at you like you're a madman. But you start talking about the possibility of alien life forms contacting us.
Can we just qualify
UFOs.
This by the other day, Dan told me that he'd become increasingly convinced about the existence of Bigfoot.
Wait a second. Hold on. Did you just say, like, oh, if you talk about Bigfoot, people are like, you're crazy. And if you talk about dinosaurs in Loch Ness,
what I was saying.
But if you talk about aliens on Earth, people are like, all right, we're getting somewhere now.
Well, sort of. I mean, there's no evidence to support any of this. No evidence to support any of it. But the scientific community does entertain the idea that aliens.
Not necessarily.
Or at least watching.
Yeah, alien. Portion. And it's, the existence of life elsewhere in the universe, I think, is thought by a lot of people to be a non-question. I think it almost certainly is. But whether we will ever encounter it or investigate it is another kind of question, which is different. I would think it's still a more reasonable hypothesis than Bigfoot. Whether UFOs is different. The zoo hypothesis, I would say, is different. But the probability of like jellyfish somewhere in space, I don't think it's particularly...
Well, that brings us to our last scientific hypothesis on this, is that aliens do exist. They do know that we're here, and they're actually here on Earth, and they're living among us undetected. This is an actual... fringe scientists do...
I love this movie. Jeff Goldblum was my favorite in it. We're talking about body snatchers, right?
But there are some fringe scientists who think that aliens walk among us.
And let's not lie, this would explain a lot, right?
It's true.
Why are you guys both looking at me?
I mean, there are fringe scientists who believe in Bigfoot and the Loch Ness Monster, too. But, yeah, so those are the theories behind alien life in a nutshell.
Nice.
Mm-hmm. Oh, okay.
That's a good way to wrap up. I think so there are people who believe it, and it's fun to think about that it's really systematic in terms of the way they believe it. And as David said, I think it's quite a non-question that it's probably out there somewhere. Mm. Probability dictates. I've learned nothing from myself from last week. So next we are going to throw it over to David after a short break. And do you want to give us a little taste?
Let's just say...
of what you're doing.
We're going to continue with Dan's slight flavor of sci-fi as we move forward from Aliens to another sci-fi classic.
Forget what you've heard when we come back. There's a starman waiting in the sky. But he thinks he'd blow our minds. There's a starman waiting in the sky. He's told us not to blow it, 'cause he knows it's all worthwhile. He told me, let the children use it. Let the children use it. Let all the children do get. We're just trying to teach you some science.
Okay. So following on from Dan's entertaining take on alien life in the universe, I thought I would focus on a classic and influential American sci-fi program from the 60s depicting utopian Earth of the future and a world where people can trek to the stars. I am, of course, talking about The Jetsons. Now, The Jetsons... It was very funny. Anyway, The Jetsons was actually set, I found this out recently, in the world of 2062, which is 49 years from now.
Well, we're pretty much there already.
And I just like, so I thought one thing I was interested in is how close are we getting to the world of The Jetsons? How long is it going to take for me to become an affable digital index operator with a talking dog, a robot maid, and an irritating little boy called Elroy?
Yeah, well, no matter how close.
Yeah.
We got the last one on lock. Yeah.
No matter how close we get to that, I'm never calling my kid Elroy.
Who calls their child Elroy? Anyway.
I thought it was a...
I'm so... Wait, we'd like to apologize right now to all the Elroys out there. I'm sure your parents had good reasons. Anyway, immediately scratching both Elroy and the talking dog, I thought about robot maids. How close are we to getting robot maids? And there was a news...
Let's just see how quickly we can wallow this into creep territory.
Or butlers. Robot servants, if you will.
Well, that's good. I'm glad that you're not orientation specific.
Anyway, I read an article in the news in which the business world is saying that we should not expect robot maids and butlers or labourers to come around anytime soon, certainly because the trade-off between the cost of investing in it to make it not just cheap but also good is too much.
And it would kill the economy of the South US.
It would also... Yes.
Sorry, keep going.
Gotta bring that political sting.
Yes, exactly. It would destroy labour markets, which are an important part of the economy and all this kind of stuff. That said, there are conditions in which robotic servants would be useful, conditions where it would be dangerous for people, for example. And one of the most prominent ones is the theme of our show this week, space. And there's actually, NASA has a long history of robots in space, which I'll just go over. First of all, we all know about rovers, so the Mars rover. I don't think they've had rovers on the moon. No, they haven't. But there's a large part of NASA which is devoted to coming up with new different types of semi-autonomous rovers going around and doing their roving things.
There is another entire division that comes up with the names for them.
There is. They all do have quite wonderful names. And God, I'd like to work in that. What do you do? I work for NASA. Where? The nomenclature department.
Especially if you would call it nomenclature or whatever you just said.
I'm sorry that I speak in an endearingly garbled way.
Home, we say nomenclature.
Right. basically, we all think of rovers as being something that looks fairly rectagonal with wheels that rolls around on the surface of other planets. But actually, if you look at the website, there's all kinds of cool-looking rovers, and there's two that I particularly like. The first of them is the LEMUR system, which stands for Limbed Excursion Mechanical Utility Robots, which is just awesome. These are robots that kind of look a little bit like crabs or spiders. Whenever you see like evil spider robots in science fiction films, it seems to be quite a strong go-to. They do look a lot like these guys. They've got, well, they're not really spiders. They've got six legs. They can swap the ends of their legs for different tools. It looks a little bit like a crab version of Wally, as it has a head that looks a bit like a rectangle with two circles on the side with the two stereo cameras. And they not only can walk around, they can also climb up climbing walls, just like people.
Like a perfectly vertical face?
Well,
oh my God.
And it's a little bit scary.
That is.
The other, so that's one of them. And then I just wanted to know, are there any other kind of walking rovers? Because this is quite cool. The other one is also an acronym named Athlete. Athlete, which stands for All-Terrain Hex-Limbed Extraterrestrial Explorer.
God, dear.
Like,
I hate when
they really shoehorn that one in there.
I hate when they do that. No, I hate when they take two letters from one word.
Oh, and they're sometimes selective about the use of the word and this kind of stuff. But anyway.
They shoehorn that in there.
The athlete one, like the lemur, is six-legged, as you might have got from Hex-Limbed in its wonderful acronym. However, it also has wheels. So at the end of each of its legs are wheels, and it can either drive around on its wheels, or it can lock the wheels in place and use the wheels as feet to clamber over difficult terrain.
Yeah, if there was like a really rocks.
It also, on the ends of its legs, has things like drills and shovels and stuff. So it can,
with wheels?
With wheels.
Like a wheel of drills.
No. Well, yes and no.
Nightmares have come true.
So if you imagine the wheel, then coming out from the middle of the wheel, so on the axle, on the axle, is a drill.
Oh my God.
And they will then use the wheel to kind of drill into stuff.
They had that on the car that Mr. Freeze drove in that movie in 97.
Oh, Batman and Robin.
That's right. Yeah.
Mm.
I thought you were going to say Death Race.
Oh yeah, that one too, I suppose, probably.
Ice Fast, Ice Furious. So there's a long tradition of NASA sending robots out onto other planets. But what about the International Space Station, to get with our theme of living in space? Now, the classic one is, as I have two Canadians with me, I'm sure you're aware, Canadarm.
Canadarm. And in fact, before you continue, I'm just going to say a little thing. My dad made part of the plastic molds and the metal that went up into the Canadarm. Oh. I have a family connection to the Canadarm.
And before we get too excited about that, my dad is a dentist.
I was going to say, I thought the Canada was a small place where everyone knows each other and everyone worked in the Canada was a massive, wonderful, utopian group project.
Imagine how much of a bummer it would have been, though, if we weren't allowed in on the project and we just had an arm with a rocket strapped back to it.
So Canadarm, or specifically Canadarm 2, I don't know what happened to Canadarm 1, launched up in 2001 to join the International Space Station. It is a 17.6-metre... just to keep metric for you all, next-generation robotic arm. It has 7 motorized joints, and it actually helped to build the International Space Station.
I should say the actual Bigelow module we're talking about, it's supposed to be brought up in 2015 by a cargo ship, but the actual, it's going to be taken off the cargo ship and attached to the International Space Station entirely by the arm.
The arm is actually quite cool in that I didn't realize this. I thought it was just an arm, but the arm is also attached to what's called the mobile base system, which can run the entire length of the International Space System.
Is it like on a rail?
Yeah, there's a rail, and it can run up and down.
That's
it.
Pretty cool.
So there, it is really cool.
17.6 meters, by the way, is about 57 feet.
Wow.
The Americans.
I thought you were going to say 17.6 meters is about 52 feet cubic.
So, however, in researching this, I also found what I think is the coolest robot that NASA has ever sent into space, and that is Robonaut, or specifically Robonaut 2.
So this is a robot that has transcended acronyms.
Yes. Robot has transcended acronyms with bad puns.
They're basically just like us.
Yeah. So this is Robonaut was a collaboration between General Motors and NASA. And the first
You go on to number two, can you tell us what happened on number one? Oh, sorry.
That's what I'm doing.
So
the first Robonaut, Robonaut 1, or just Robonaut, is actually quite terrifying looking. I've got an image here that I'm going to show Dan.
It's a shame it's a podcast.
But it looks a little bit like, if you imagine Boba Fett crossed with the Rocketeer, that's the head.
I do every night.
You then chop the head off Arnold Schwarzenegger back in his Mr. Universe days, and you stick Boba Fett / Rocketeer's head onto Arnold Schwarzenegger. You then chop him off at the waist and stick him onto a small car.
It actually is the helmet of Boba Fett, you're right.
You know that...
It's Rocketeer color. It looks Rocketeer-y as well in other bits.
You literally know that step by step you are dissecting one of the characters out of the Twisted Metal video games, right?
I don't know that.
Oh, dear. I'm going to have to make you look that up later.
But this is what it looks like. It looks quite scary. The main argument... So Robonaut is deliberately designed to be humanoid, at least from the waist up. It has a head which contains cameras. It has hands which are incredibly dexterous and involved with lots of sensors and all kinds of other stuff. It does, however, look terrifying. The wheeled base bit that it rides around on, in at least in this picture, is also quite creepily referred to as the Centaur base, as though this is some kind of mechanical centaur.
Wow.
Because no, we all know that cars are the equivalent of horses.
Yeah, well, if we're talking about like a robot that's supposed to be the pinnacle of everything, I mean, you have to have humans meeting with the only other equivalent animal, which is, of course, a centaur.
Obviously.
Yeah, I'd say that's pretty good. You did a pretty good breakdown description then.
So the second Robonaut, Robonaut 2, is a much slicker-looking robot.
That's naked.
It's not naked. It just doesn't wear clothes. It's a robot.
Selling out to GM, too.
This is a level of anthropomorphism I'm not comfortable with.
So it is still quite creepy-looking. It's got more of a... Battlestar Galactica helmet
We will attach these pictures to the podcast.
Yeah, we will find some way of getting them into the
I think we can do that.
Making these descriptions obsolete.
Exactly.
But way more fun.
It still is quite creepy looking, though. It probably falls into what we refer to as the uncanny valley.
Yeah. Especially this one's reaching out to grab something.
Oh, this one. There's all kinds of photos of Robonaut posing, both with its arms up in triumph, which is quite scary, or just doing weights, or giving the thumbs up, which is probably the creepiest one I've seen so far. It was launched into space and joined the International Space Station in 2011. The Robonaut 2 in particular is very dexterous. It has, I don't know quite what this means, but it has what is described as extreme neck travel, which sounds like, I don't know, I don't even think what that
sounds like.
I wish
I had that when I had to take the flights back to Canada.
The Robonaut itself has over 350 sensors and over 38 processors. 38 processors, and it's got sensors within the fingers that allow it to manipulate objects really, really carefully and very accurately.
Its hands have
12 degrees of freedom, the motion of their hands. The idea of it is it's supposed to be able to carry out dangerous tasks on the station. For example, going in and replacing air filters when there's in a vacuum and other such things. It is both can be controlled from the ground or from other people in the space station, but the idea of it is that it's semi-autonomous. You can set it to do a task, and then Robonaut will just keep going and doing that task until the task is finished.
Does it have to be humanoid like that?
I was just going to ask if there's an actual reason why the reason they insist
is,
on human,
yeah, no, the reason humanoid. Is that it should be able to use all the tools that the astronauts would use.
Oh, okay.
So that's why it needs hands.
Yeah, but how about, like,
why it needs
the
a head
body?
Is probably because it makes it easier to make love to. I honestly don't know.
Do you think, the fact that they're in, like, this is NASA in conjunction with a commercial venture?
Quite possibly.
Well, it says GM really, right on it.
Yeah, it is. Well, it was built by GM.
Do you think do you think part of this is because it's a snazzy
thing? Yeah, I think
part of this is probably why GM went bankrupt.
So it looks much less kind of practical than the athlete or the lemur.
I mean, the helmet's gold for you.
it is awesome looking.
It's got a gold backpack. That this
bot is balling so hard.
It is. So
they obviously got carried away.
The creepiest one is they have projections of what they could do with Robonaut in the future, and that includes attaching legs to it. And it's got a drawing of Robonaut putting a flag on the moon. His legs.
Let's just be happy that we dodged some kind of creep bullet there.
No. Oh, there's all kinds of creepy.
As long as it's just putting a flag in the moon.
I saw a website that sells a Robonaut.
That's the same site that David used last week for sex rolls.
That was not a Robonaut.
Sorry, you're right. Keep going.
Anyway. Oh, these. There is a series of very creepy pictures that we will add on to the internet.
Maybe we'll just give links to them.
My favorite aspect of Robonaut has to be, aside of the posing, is that Robonaut is somewhat of a celebrity. Robonaut has his own Twitter account, and we see here is Astro Robonaut, at Astro Robonaut, just to read a couple. Hey, it looks like it's time to power down. Gave my team a lot of valuable data today.
No. The second one is, I have no human emotions. I'm so cold inside.
Rotated 180 degrees. Time to check out my elbow joints.
The third one is, I accidentally killed Karen today with my superhuman strength.
But my favorite one is someone who wrote on...
I'm a real-life boy.
I don't know how sarcastically they were saying this, but they said, I have a feeling it's not going to be good for the astronauts when Robonaut becomes self-aware, and then hashtag Skynet, hashtag guns in space, hashtag conspiracy. Right? Followed by Robonaut going like, why? What, me? This person then responds, come on, let's be real here. You have some kind of directive tucked away in you for just the right moment. Hashtag government. Robonauts. Just a directive to be awesome.
Oh, bless you, Robonaut.
Although there's a pun in there, because the first thing he says is, I have a feeling it's going to be bad when Robonaut becomes self-aware, and then he responds with, who, me?
Robonaut's like, who, me?
I think they snuck in a joke that the guy didn't pick up on.
You mean Robonaut snuck in a joke?
Yeah, Robonaut.
That's true. That's
Robonaut true. Kicks all kinds of ass. there's many reasons.
Oh, it's also not quite programmed useful. To detect humor.
It is also quite useful. I mean, the technology used.
I know Dan, but we're talking about Robonaut.
So Robonaut is also really useful in that some of the technologies from Robonaut have actually been used for quite practical purposes on the International Space Station. They created something called the Human Grasp Assist, or K-Glove, uses technology from Robonaut's hands. The idea being that if you're working on the spaceship or space station or whatever, you are under risk of repetitive strain injury from working all day, every day, using the same tools.
Here it comes again. Anyway.
So this...
Insert your own horrible, horrible, horrible...
There's not a lot to do in space. There's...
Not if you don't have a robot.
You have to be up in the space station for a long time before this thing becomes, you know, human comfort for you, but...
Judging... I'm going to just go off David's facial expression and guess that he wasn't expecting this much implied sexual humor.
No, as soon as I saw this topic, I was like, yeah, it's going this way.
This anyway. It's okay, you're going to love this, then. The human grasp assist...
Not as much as the astronauts.
The human grasp assist glove. It's reduced repetitive strain injury by reducing the amount of force required to hold tools. Anyway, it has pressure sensors in the fingertips. When it's grasping something, it can then detect it, and synthetic tendons will retract and keep the hand in the grasping position.
Absolutely, yeah.
Until you just need to kind of slightly fight against it and let go of whatever you're holding, and then it just releases.
Okay.
So that was actually based on the technology they used in Robonaut's hands, only it was algorithmically based for picking stuff up.
Well, if it kept its hand in a grasping position, that could be a real problem.
Yes.
Real
Everyone would know what Robonaut was up to. Anyway, just to lead into the next segment, which I believe Zach will read us, Robonaut also had to be prepared for space. Space is tough on Robonauts. And so before Robonaut could go up, there was extensive testing. He had to be made radiation tolerant. He had to be shielded against electromagnetic interference. And also, for the sake of the astronauts, he had to have his fans silenced. Because otherwise, everyone was going to hate Robonaut and they wouldn't get on.
I kind of hate him already, yeah.
Because he just has a directive to be awesome.
And in space, nobody can hear your heartless, soulless cries for emotion. Yeah.
Anyway, that was Robonaut, and I think Robonaut is a lot of fun.
That was pretty wonderful.
I hope you guys didn't want to sleep tonight.
And so, like David said, we're just going to take a quick break, and I will come back with... I just want to end it on that really high note about all the horrible ways and things that happen to your body when you're exposed to space without any kind of protection. In the meantime, just keep your eyes open for Dan's overly graphic Robonaut fanfiction that should be releasing next week. We'll be right back.
Boba Fett.
Check.
Boba Fett.
So, on these last of the bigger segments, I get to talk about all the horrible things that will happen to you if you ever decide to spend that cool 25 mil plus change, visit the space station, and end up getting ejected out of a spaceship.
Possibly when Robonaut becomes sentient and turns against its masters.
Yes. I will teach you for making me grasp all those tools. I apologize, Robonaut. I will send you an apology tweet.
It's good that Robonaut is kind of wiped clean, isn't it?
So I wanted to start with trying to dispel some of the major myths, because basically in science fiction movies, getting ejected into space is just gives you complete control over whatever you want to do in terms of special effects, right? You see things like people getting instantly frozen, and of course you're like, well, it's space, right? You see people blood boiling and their eyeballs popping out, like in Total Recall with Arnold Schwarzenegger. All right, Dan.
Easy, Dan.
I think you're just a bit too
close
to the mic.
We'll have lunch
soon. So the first one of the myths I actually thought about was, would you stay conscious if you were ejected into space, right? Because if you think about it, in a lot of these movies, people are ejected into space and you see them kind of flailing and freaking out, and it's a very conscious thing. But how conscious would you actually be in this case? Do you guys have any ideas?
I'm going to assume you've died nearly immediately.
Yeah. Thinking about the other stuff that will happen to your body that I'm sure you're going to come to,
yeah.
I think the shock alone would knock you out.
Okay. So, well, first of all, I'll have you know that everything we've learned about... So what I'm going to be talking about mostly when I talk about exposure to space is exposure to a near vacuum.
Okay.
So space isn't an entire vacuum. There are molecules out there, but the density of them is so small that it's practically a vacuum, so there's nothing out there. Mm. And actually, everything we've kind of learned about it through everything actually suggests it's survivable to a very short period of time, but it's not, nothing's as instant as we're always thought of as movies. So in terms of consciousness, it's not like we're talking about a lot of time here, but it's thought that the highest kind of limit is a 9 to 11 seconds of quote-unquote useful consciousness. Yeah. So that's where you'd be able to operate
things. Enough to kind of think, oh no, I've been sucked out into space.
Exactly, and this is only talking about something like explosive depressurization, and that means like instant exposure fully to space. So it's some kind of hypothetical situation. Like if you were in an airlock and they all of a sudden shot you
out. If you were hanging out at Space Station Alpha and you popped your beam.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah, if you popped your beam. If Robonaut popped your beam.
Yeah.
And you got ejected into space. After 9 to 11 seconds, basically other things like hypoxia, like lack of oxygen and other effects I'll talk about in a bit, would actually knock you out. But the actual reason we know so much about the consciousness in a hypothetical situation is because of high altitude aviation, which we've been doing for a much longer period of time than space exploration. So the well-known effects of high altitude aviation is that once you get over 50,000 feet or 15 kilometers, there's one conversion I did.
What about miles?
Shut up. We know that above 50,000 feet and higher is where you start getting into the range of 9 to 11 seconds of, again, quote unquote, useful consciousness in terms of you can operate things, you can talk.
Okay.
Well, I don't know about talking, but you can definitely operate things. However, Some of the experts in aerospace actually argue that that time is probably a maximum, because if all of a sudden you were ejected into space, you've got factors like surprise, and that your entire body is probably going to enter some kind of higher metabolic state. You're going to be full of adrenaline, probably. So they actually cut down that time to 5 seconds.
Oh, okay. So just enough time to think, oh.
I don't think, oh no, I've been sucked into.
Now, what I'm going to say, though, is that even though you are unconscious, that doesn't mean you're dead. And actually, if anything, you're far from it. Mm. When we start talking about how much time it takes before someone's for sure dead in space, we actually have a much bigger time window. Which leads me to my next myth, which is, would your blood boil?
Why would it boil?
So I hear a lot of this.
It's to do with the pressure changes, is the idea.
Absolutely, yeah. So the idea behind it is that the boiling point of water changes depending on pressure. And so yeah. When you get this lower external pressure, it actually increases the boiling point of water. And so the actual pressure differentials, so the difference between inside and outside of your body change. So what does happen, and what we do know, is that if you're exposed to a near vacuum, any kind of bodily fluids that are accessible to the environment would boil, and they do, and they vaporize. They boil right off.
Like saliva.
So saliva is the best and most classic example, but also the fluid in your eyes will do that. And so that'll actually boil off, and that's because when you enter a near vacuum, the pressure is so low that water will just boil at such a low temperature. Now, the reason your blood doesn't boil is because it's a closed system, right? You've got all your blood vessels, and they're all connected, and it's closed. There's no access to the outside, so that there's actually a maintained pressure on the inside. And so it doesn't actually, it's not exposed to this basically zero pressure of space. So instead, boiling point of water, so assuming a typical blood pressure measurement of like 75 over 100, which for our purposes is just something within the completely normal range, you would actually expect the boiling point of water goes to 46 degrees Celsius. And 46 degrees Celsius, as we know, is well above human body temperature. Mm-hmm. So you're actually, your blood wouldn't boil because it's nowhere near hot enough in your body for the actual blood, even at that greatly changed pressure difference.
Right.
Okay.
However, that being said, as we know, the blood pressure is different depending on where you measure it in the body, right? Mm. Like right out of the heart, it's nice and high, but other parts in the extremities get quite low. Yeah. And so actually, some of your blood might boil in certain pockets.
But that's the worst part for it to boil in.
The only negative effects, though, are you're going to talk about like in really small blood vessels and the extremities of your body. And all that does is it vaporizes it, and that actually puts gas into the circulatory system, which is horrible because that leads to stuff like embolisms where you can get blocked arteries. However, the only thing that we're going to talk about that is that with the extra gas in your circulatory system, it actually increases the pressure in your veins. So the less oxygenated blood.
Mm.
But we'll come back and talk that in a second. But so no, your blood would not boil instantly.
Okay.
I was kind of like, I say all these are myths because they are things you kind of see in movies a lot, but really they're all just kind of letdowns to me.
Oh,
yeah. So you just sort of die.
I don't think I can believe anything in Total Recall anymore.
Well, I believe in Arnold.
I think you mean Colin Farrell.
Oh, no, it's such a bad, it's such a bad remake. Sorry.
I'd rather recast Sharon Stone into that role.
So the last myth is would you freeze? So I mentioned that before.
Mm-hmm.
So would you freeze? Again, sadly, because this is an opener segment of letdowns, no, you would not freeze. So as I mentioned before, moisture on the outside of the body would instantly vaporize or boil and then vaporize. And just like when you sweat and your sweat evaporates off your skin, you get evaporative cooling, right?
Mm-hmm.
So because you sweat because the moisture of the sweat that evaporates actually takes heat away from your body. And because evaporative cooling, that's essentially what's exactly happening with like the saliva in your mouth and stuff.
Mm-hmm.
So because it would do it and vaporize so quickly, you actually get local frostbite to your airways. Your eyes, I guess, could potentially get it when all the moisture leaves because it leaves so quickly. It takes so much heat that you actually can freeze.
Oh.
However, your body itself is going to be pretty fine. And that's because if you think about styrofoam or insulation, one of the best insulators is just space, right? Mm. It's a vacuum.
Mm.
And so space is actually a pretty wonderful insulator, and that's because there's nowhere for the heat to go. There's no molecules to take away the heat from your body. And so your body will actually, it will lose heat, but it'll do so quite slowly.
Could you tell us how cold it is in space?
So that's the thing, is space doesn't really have a temperature, because you measure temperature by the movement of molecules, right? That's the effect of temperature.
It was a trick question.
And look who's tricked. You are. That I was prepared for once. next I wanted to talk about. So those are three major myths. Sadly, I guess the consciousness one I think is kind of the coolest, but it's sad that the other two aren't true.
That would be the worst 5 seconds of your life, though.
Yeah, sure. Well,
and my hands are boiling.
Some of the last. Wait, how did I get up into?
How did I instantly transfer? Yeah, exactly. This is a very hypothetical situation. Yeah. So what actually happens?
I knew I shouldn't have pulled that catapult back so far.
So, curse you, Robonaut.
So I found a nice kind of succinct publication by an MD who actually did their residency in aerospace medicine.
Oh, I was so hoping you were going to say on Mars.
No, no, sadly not. So again, we're talking about explosive depressurization. So just you enter all the sudden entrance into a near vacuum. And they say it has three main effects, or three parts of the body it predominantly affects. Mm-hmm. I would argue that it basically affects the first two, and then the third one is just a side product. Mm. And it's not nearly, the third one's not nearly as bad as what you think. So the first, and arguably, and probably unsurprisingly, the biggest and worst effects can happen to the lungs.
Mm. Yeah.
So, and the first effects I'm going to say could have been prevented entirely if you just opened your mouth. But we're going to assume you didn't. So the second you're exposed to space, you take a deep breath. Which is kind of, like, intuitive, right? You think that you're like, oh, I got to hold on to that oxygen, so I'm going to take a deep breath and
seal. Oh, that's what you call off the airway as you enter space.
Right?
Okay, yeah.
So, yeah, in those 5 seconds of consciousness, yeah. You're like, yeah, I'm going to get this. I know what I'm doing. Yep. Don't do that, because that makes a closed giant pocket of air, and the change in pressure will cause that gas to expand like crazy. Expand so much that, of course, so you get an overpressurization, but basically your lungs inflate beyond what they are prepared for, and they tear. And the alveoli, which are like the small sacs where the actual air exchange, where the oxygen enters the bloodstream, they actually can rupture.
Oh.
And then you get nice old hemorrhaging, which is just bleeding in the lungs, of course. So to break it down even further than that.
How did she test this?
Is it even possible to, because would it not happen anyway through your nose?
Well, if you seal off your airway, it's just you have to have that closed.
You have to really kind of tightly seal off your airways.
Not even tightly, because this stuff happens so instantly. That it's not going to like blow out your mouth.
And even
if
you were exhaling as fast as you could, even if you could somehow equalize that pressure, you'd just suffocate.
Well, so I'll get to that in a second.
Sorry.
So the actual within the lungs, so again, assuming this closed airway and your closed mouth, the upper lung is the part that's actually going to expand, and that's going to generate this breathlessness sensation because you pretty much are breathless at that point. Mm. And the bottom of the lung, that's where all the blood and fluids are going to collect, but it's also going to collapse.
So much like if a balloon goes too high in the air. Sort of pops at one end. And
yeah, absolutely. Okay. That'll happen to your lungs.
Oh, wonderful.
So, of course, like I said, this could all be prevented if you just left your mouth open when you were suddenly exposed to space. But, of course, the problem with that is the way that we get oxygen into our system is because of a gradient. There's more oxygen in the air than in the blood that runs around in our lungs. And that's how oxygen comes through in diffusion. However, in space, there's barely any, absolutely no oxygen, pretty much, in the outer space. So, instead, your deoxygenated blood from your veins actually still has more than the external environment, so you're going to constantly be pouring oxygen out of your body into the environment.
Sounds like an awful place to
be. It's a process called off-gassing, which is kind of a funny term. But yeah, so you're actually going to be giving up all your oxygen to the environment, as well as all the other major gases in your blood.
What about like your eardrums and things like that?
So eardrums are super sensitive to pressure, too. So I'll talk about it. I didn't read too much about it, but presumably it's pretty easy to rupture such a thing, especially with an exposure to a near vacuum.
I had a ruptured eardrum once. I didn't feel it, but it was a...
They actually have...
apparently it happens all the time.
Do you get better?
It takes about 6 weeks.
Oh. Yeah, they can actually heal,
but
yeah.
But it wasn't all that painful.
So the actual thing is, when it comes to eardrum damage, I didn't write down the actual reference, but they actually have stages of eardrum damage. And someone I'll talk about later suffered fourth stage eardrum damage, which I imagine is pretty bad.
Yeah,
eardrum
that sounds, that sounds
the ear
really painful.
Detached from the head.
The outside of the ear as well is just completely left. So the major effects, like I said, are in the lungs, and it's a damned if you do, damned if you don't, whether or not you want to open your mouth or not. I suppose I would probably open my mouth. I would not want my lungs to just rip inside of my body.
So opening your mouth would just make one giant continuous exhalation up until all your oxygen.
Basically, everything would just be pouring out of your mouth. Yeah. Also, if you think about it, if you open up your mouth, that's a lot more vapor and gases and water being exposed to the external environment, which means you could probably also get some of those freezing effects by evaporative cooling right through your airway. So, if that didn't turn you off, the next effects are on the heart.
I feel like I can survive the first stage.
Nothing can turn me off now.
So I actually think that the heart
the next
has
effects are on the heart.
I actually think that the heart has some of the coolest effects, and I'll tell you why. And also, part of what happens to the heart can actually determine whether or not you could actually rehabilitate someone. So a lot of what we know about approaching near vacuum is actually conducted on Earth when they're testing spacesuits in actual vacuum chambers.
Okay.
So there is chances that if something goes wrong, that there's ways to diagnose whether or not, like, what kind of effects it's going to actually have on a person. So with the heart, initially on exposure, your heart rate will increase, However, within a minute, it will go back down to about 40% of your basal heart rate.
Would that increase your capacity for love?
For the first 20 seconds, you could reach peace with the entire world. But then you go back down to only 40% of your normal baseline heart rate. So you just really hate everything.
Like Grinch-like
levels. Yeah, I was going to say, that's the opposite of what happened to the
Grinch. His heart beat three times too small. And then, so as I mentioned before, too, is you're going to get vaporization in your in the vein system. So you actually are getting pressure in your... So the way that our heart normally works is the heart beats, and that generates a pressure difference in our circulatory system that pushes blood from the arteries, which has oxygen, to all the muscles in the body. And at the same time, the lower pressure in the venous system, which is has to go to the lungs and get more oxygen, works. That actually is what pushes it through the heart to the lungs, is that it's got a lower pressure in that system, whereas the arterial system has a higher pressure. However, when exposed to space, as I mentioned before, because of this vaporization in some parts of your blood system, is the venous system starts increasing in pressure and the arterial system starts decreasing. So maybe you would think that it's like, oh, maybe it'll go in reverse. But it wouldn't, because, again, this is still a closed system, so there is a pressure across everything. But what happens is your blood stops moving.
Oh.
You no longer have that pressure difference that keeps blood driving throughout the rest of your body. Oh. However, your heart keeps beating.
Oh,
okay.
Your heart remains contracting, but because of this new pressure added to the closed system, the heart's beats don't do anything meaningful in terms of pushing blood.
They will push it a little bit through the heart?
There's nothing.
They just don't push it through the rest of the body.
Yeah, there's like no meaningful blood flow throughout the body.
Throughout the body.
Yeah.
But around the heart area.
Well, it's not meaningful though.
No, that's not meaningful. Yeah. I know it's not going around the rest of the body, but the heart is still doing stuff.
So the heart could probably move blood around, maybe just around it. Like, I don't know the details of this, and I don't think we could monitor the details of it, right, when you expose someone to a vacuum.
You'd have to throw someone's heart.
It's basically like your blood stops moving throughout your body.
Yeah.
It's that simple.
Oh.
But the crazy thing is, I think, is that your heart still keeps beating, and your heart continues to beat for 2 to 5 minutes. And what they've learned is that if you can get to a person who's been exposed to this near vacuum while their heart's still beating, even though they're at this point clearly unconscious, and their hearts or their blood stopped moving, their lungs might be ruptured, they actually can be rehabilitated as long as the heart is still beating. But once you reach asystole, or the heart stops beating, it might be a closed case on that point.
Ah.
And that's, isn't that neat? Like, I think it's absolutely crazy to think of a situation where your heart beats.
So you need to be, as long as you're out in space for less than the time it takes to play Johnny B. Good, you will be okay.
I don't know about space, okay. Honestly.
Well, about the quarter of the time.
Your eyes, your ears will have detached. But
you might not want to be rehabilitated.
Robonaut will love you no more.
So, Robonaut's thinking at least you have a heart.
So I think that, so the third effect is on the central nervous system, or the brain and spinal cord. But I don't think this is a real effect. Okay. Basically, everything we see that's a problem in terms of this near vacuum effects on the brain is just a decreased blood flow, which is really an effect of the heart. So I wouldn't argue it. However, I did write down my favorite effect, which I read this on, I can't remember what the guy's name is. He's a science writer, and he collected this beautiful amount of information on this stuff. And actually has citations on, like, most internet sites that if you ask what happens to your body in space, this one actually had references.
All right.
And he actually was talking about effects on the gastrointestinal tract.
Oh, okay. Here it comes.
It's really funny, though. He put this as one of his first effects, but basically it's you just get a little bloated, but the abdominal pain would be no different than if you just had a lot of gas. And the way to alleviate it is just by farting more.
Okay.
That was literally the first paragraph. I started writing stuff down, and I got to the end of it and realized it was just not a serious problem.
There's some cartoon or something where somebody gets stuck in space and they start farting to propel themselves forward. And if you had any oxygen in your lungs, any air in your lungs, you could just blow to go back the other way.
Yeah, I wonder if you get
a problem, because the oxygen would be constantly coming out of your mouth and nose.
That's true.
So if you kept that open, that would be propelling you in the opposite direction.
Well, the only thing I wonder then is if you were out and then you started farting, would you get butt frostbite? Because I would rather let my lungs collapse and just feel a little tummy ache.
Either way, you're only going to feel this for 5 to 10 seconds.
Exactly. You're not going to feel it for very long. You'll pass out and then you'll fart anyway.
So now that we know what actually happens. So again, there's a lot of other effects. There's things like you get sunburnt because of the radiation, obviously, exposure. There's issues with just exposure to radiation, even when you're living in a space station, obviously. And people are doing tests on these all the time. But it seemed like in terms of just getting all of a sudden ejected into space, that's what we're looking at. But what I think is actually really impressive, though, is that everything we've learned about it suggests that there's a lot more survivability to it than we initially thought. Everyone originally thought that exposure to space was an instant death kind of thing. Whereas everything we found, especially with like the cardiac effects, is that there might actually be a couple minutes where you could save someone. And so Dan asked earlier, briefly, how we know some of this stuff. And a lot of what we know is based on accidental exposures to near vacuum conditions.
Oh, okay. Case studies.
And so I'm going to talk about some of the really famous cases. And then I'm going to end it off with an actual exposure to space.
Okay.
There has been at least one, but it's not as exciting as it sounds.
Is he alive?
So the first one, or one of the first examples, one of the first examples that really changed our ideas of how survivable exposure to these environmental conditions could be actually happened in 1960 with Joe Kittinger, I believe, who actually is a record holder for the largest parachute jump.
Okay.
Yeah. And during his ascent, he realized that he could no longer feel his right hand. And he...
As it floated away from him.
That was the first Canadarm.
Joe Kittinger, he knew about the effects of altitude, and he knew that this was probably going to hurt, and his hand started swelling.
Oh,
so one thing I didn't mention is that because, again, you're getting an expansion of gases, is that a lot of moisture vaporizes underneath your skin. So if you're in space, I read you can actually... It's called subcutaneous swelling. It's just swelling below the skin. You could actually double your volume as a human being. Forgot to mention that. That's a pretty cool effect.
That's an incredibly cool thing.
Yeah.
But I'm surprised you didn't mention that, because that would be something that cinematically would look good.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
Not
you
good,
wouldn't explode.
But cinematically would look
You
scary.
Wouldn't explode, but...
It'd be like Kirby.
Yeah.
You would look exactly like Kirby. Okay, sorry. So Joe Kittinger, on his ascent, I can't remember what the altitude was, but at a certain altitude, he noticed his hand was failing to receive oxygen, and he couldn't feel it. And he didn't tell his ground crew, because he wanted to do a record parachute jump, and as he got higher, it became useless. He couldn't move it, couldn't do anything.
Okay. Oh, this was before he even jumped.
This is on his ascent. Okay. He just never told the ground crew during it.
Okay.
And then he got to his top, he jumped, he came down, people saw his giant swollen hand, and 3 hours later, he was completely fine. No lasting damage whatsoever.
Oh, good.
I was hoping he later told his crew that he didn't tell anyone about it as he flailed his hook at them wildly.
And then only 6 years later, so that was just kind of like, that was one of the big turning points in terms of maybe what we understand about a vacuum isn't as scary as we thought. And then in 1966, a technician who was testing a spacesuit in an actual pressurized chamber in Houston, Texas, all of a sudden there was a defect in the suit, and he had an instant exposure to an altitude of 120,000 feet.
Ouch.
So he passed out. Unsurprisingly, it did not take long for him to pass out. He came to at an altitude of about 14,000 feet, so he was out for a little bit.
Okay.
But he said when he came to... he said the last thing he remembered before passing out was the saliva boiling off of his tongue.
Ow.
Oh.
So a very good confirmation of that effect, I find. And then in 1982, there was another kind of defect during spacesuit testing, but it was in a pressurized chamber. However, this one was extended. This was multiple minutes.
You'd think they'd have safety measures for this sort of thing.
So they do. That's why. So in the first condition, they could repressurize him, and he ended up no problem. He didn't even go to the hospital in that 1966 one.
He just walked it off. If you ate a hot pizza.
Sure. His tongue burned, yeah.
So why did this one take so long? Did they just
him
as much?
So this one is an accidental exposure. It was another technician. However, there was something wrong with the repressurization system. So the way they actually brought the guy back or got to him was that the manager actually had to kick a valve off of the actual chamber just to allow air to leak in and gradually repressurize the system.
So not only was there a defect in the suit he was testing, but the repressurization system didn't work.
Yeah, or it didn't work too, whatever.
Budget cuts for that one, yeah.
Yeah, exactly.
So when they found
that... However, they're really, really strong kickers. The
manager straight to the big leagues. So when they found the technician, he was passed out, he was cyanotic, so he was all blue from lack of oxygen. He was frothing at the mouth, which might be another effect of this boiling. His lungs were bleeding. Beautiful. And he also had, again, this was the fourth stage eardrum damage.
Oh my god, yeah.
However, so they repressurized him, he was hospital. They actually repressurized him a couple hours later. And then he went to the hospital, they put him through rehab, and a year later he did a neurological exam and had no lasting neurological damage.
Except for they're like, oh, how do you feel? And he said, what?
He actually outperformed his previous score on a neurological exam. And so, however, in terms of an actual exposure to space, I could only find one in actual detail. And like I said, it's a bit of a disappointment. But this is actually, it was posted on, I think it was like space.sci or some, which sounds really dubious. But it was posted by Gregory Bennett, who's the head of the Artemis Project, which is one of the commercial enterprises to reach the moon, I think. It was some kind of aerospace commercial venture. So private, a very private adventure.
Very private adventure.
It's really exciting, but we can't tell you.
So he said that in
Bigelow 3,
when they were actually doing outside of the vehicle exploration, so they're in a spacesuit, exposed to space, and an actual palm restraint within the glove of the spacesuits became free, and it was moving around the suit and actually ended up puncturing part of the actual glove, so exposing part of the hand. So it wasn't like this explosive depressurization I've been talking about. It would have been like a leak. However, the astronaut was completely fine and never noticed anything except for that he felt a sting on his hand. And so when he came back into the spaceship, he looked at his hand and realized there was this giant burnt, bleeding mark. And it turns out that the puncture, his skin was so close to it that it basically...
sealed off.
Well, kind of, yeah. So he was cut, and then the exposure, he started bleeding out into space.
Oh.
And the blood coagulated and actually sealed the hole almost immediately.
That's amazing.
That is a really...
It's remarkable what the human body is able to do, isn't it?
So he exposed, so he got cut, and then he attached, and then he said, "I feel more machine than man." And so that's the only actual exposure to space I could actually come across. So there's some debunked myths.
I was hoping your story was going to end with, "And if you look real close at the night sky, and with a little bit of luck, you'll still see him orbiting around."
Yes. So there's some debunked myths, a little bit of what actually would happen to you on immediate exposure to space, and then some actual examples.
Oh. All right. So the moral of that story, space, not all that scary.
Hi.
And then do you want to take a little break?
Yeah,
and
a little
then we'll
break.
We'll come back with a quote-unquote fun end segment.
From the real experts of the internet.
All right. We'll be back. You've got me floating around and round, always up, you never let me down. The amazing thing, you turn me on naturally, and I kiss you when I please.
Okay, so we've been sitting here talking about aliens and talking about robots in space and talking about what happens if, you know, the vast unfathomables of the universe. But
Boiling tongues.
Boiling tongues, things of this nature.
The unfathomable boiling tongues is the new name of our three-piece. Check out for our LP being released later this week.
I thought we agreed we were going to call our band Human Grasp Assist.
Robonaut and Human Grasp Assist.
Yeah.
Anyway... We're talking about the universe, things like this, but we're not qualified to do so. We're not space explorers. We don't work with NASA. In fact, we're barely even scientists, really. We don't know these things. And so I wanted to get to the source of the matter. I really wanted to find out the deep, deep details of space, the things that really matter. So I went to Yahoo Answers.
Oh,
good. Went to Yahoo Answers, got the real questions, the real questions that matter. Wanted to find out what mattered to people. So I've got a series of questions. I'm going to let you both answer, and I'm going to tell you who's closer to the real, answer.
You can't say the real answer on Yahoo Answers. There's no such thing as a real.
No, it's the best answer. It's voted upon by the people.
Yeah, so it must be true.
The people's answer.
Everyone knows that knowledge is a democracy.
The best answer. The person who gets closest to that wins that question. You ready?
Right.
Okay, question number one. What if aliens had babies with monkeys and it created the human? David, your thoughts?
Well, I think this certainly explains why there are still monkeys, right? That's the real nail in the coffin of evolution, right? I think the answer is going to be this is highly plausible and would explain mitochondrial DNA patterns.
Zach?
I'm going to just go, coming probably with a little bit more experience with the Yahoo Answers, I'm going to have to... go with the best voted answer is probably something along the lines of like, clearly this is not what happened because I have had sex with a monkey and it did not give birth to an alien.
That's true. Oh, that was a weird weekend,
well,
wasn't it?
The real answer, you're both wrong.
Ah.
Answer, of course, is how would aliens evolved on a complete different planet be able to breed fertile offspring with monkeys?
Oh. I'm sorry, Yahoo Answers. I didn't know we were Yahoo more questions.
I feel bad that is actually such a good answer.
Question number two. Do spirits and or some extraterrestrials feed on fear or negative energy? Do they feed on negative energy? Hello, I was freaked out one dark morning when I was thinking about ghosts and extraterrestrials. When my battery
ghosts
powered...
Ghosts and extraterrestrials?
When my...
One in the same.
I gotta get the question out there. When my battery-powered smoke alarm started to sound. This smoke detector had a good condition battery and is not connected to the main power grid, and there was no smoke or fire at the time. Could it be some sort of EMP or something else? Your thoughts, Zach?
What's the actual question?
So I think...
Is it the negative energy thing? Or
they
is it
feed
that?
On negative energy because their power or their fire alarm went off and there was no fire.
Yeah, and the battery was okay.
I don't see what you're confused about.
Well,
they or do they not feed on negative energy? His fire alarm's not going off on its own.
I'm just happy to know that someone else...
Ghosts and other extraterrestrials. Come on, do they?
I'm just happy to find out that someone else believes in the relationship between ghosts and UFOs. You know what? I'm going to say on Yahoo Answers, just a succinct yes. Thank you for your patronage.
Good.
I would say... This explains a lot. My alarm goes off all the time. I also think of ghosts and extraterrestrials, so I think this is the likely outcome.
Okay.
There's a ghost comes to my house every morning at 7.
This explains
in
a lot.
In that way that you guys are both right, this is a multi-sentence answer.
Is that the way that we're right?
The best one, well,
the
no.
The first sentence is
the best
yes.
answer is from somebody called Gollum or Outrider. Some spirit/energy beings feed on fear and other sinking energies as part of the energetic ecosystem that is our world. The way worms feed on fungi, feed on dead leaves in a forest, turning dead energy back into fertile, useful energy. The best way to tell if you have energy parasite is to sense for them when you're having panic attack or right before you wake up from a nightmare. If you're being fed upon, you will feel a dark presence in the room with you, right or often right next to you if it was from the nightmare. It can be quite scary when you first sense them, but don't get freaked out. That only feeds them. Question number 3.
Wait.
No, come on. You can't just leave us with that.
Wait. No, you're both right.
The biologist in me just died a little bit from hearing about how worms feed on fungi, which feed on leaves, which creates dead energy into living, rejuvenating energy.
They didn't place any comments here either. The way worms or fungi feed on dead leaves in a forest feed on... Yeah.
Guys, I think I've got an energy parasite.
Don't get freaked out. It will only feed them more.
The dark presence in the room following nightmares is just me.
My phone isn't ringing. What does this mean? Yahoo Answers!
My watch isn't connected to a wire and it's ticking right now.
It's in the room.
Question number 3. Is it true that both Obama and Romney cater to the interests of extraterrestrial overlords?
Well, okay, I know.
David, your thoughts. Oh, wait, sorry. The rest of the question was, there's a tagline, then the question. Is it true that both Obama and Romney cater to the interests of extraterrestrial overlords? Both Obama and Romney are pawns of the Illuminati. The Illuminati serves as extraterrestrial overlords who need our planet's oil resources to fight the war with the Andromeda Galaxy. So why does it matter if I vote?
So first of all, you make a good point. However, I think the problem is that this question is being too broad about extraterrestrials. Because, for example... Greys, they're not working for the Greys, they're working for the reptilians. You can tell this by studying, you should know about this, Dan, studying the facial features of famous people all sync up in a way that suggests a reptilian outcome, or a reptilian source, and they're actually secretly reptiles, such as on the classic 80s/recently revived series V. So, yes and no, they are the pawns of aliens, but I think the Illuminati, if anything, is only kind of slightly externally related.
Okay, Zach.
Again, just coming from the... a bit of a historical perspective, Yahoo Answers. I'm going to say that the top-rated answer is probably something along the lines of, don't take our guns! And maybe a second line to that answer would be, get her done.
Close, actually, but I think David takes this one.
Dang.
Some fluke of statistics, the answer is the best answer, as chosen by the asker this time. The Illuminati are nothing more than students to the teachings of interdimensional reptilian aliens. Hit the nail on the head that time, David.
And yes,
they are puppets, the projected consciousness of them, ... I don't know who they're talking about. I guess the interdimensional reptilian aliens.
I think the thing is, this just shows every now and again, Yahoo Answers actually does come up with the correct, reasonable answer. So,
of course, they did miss the end of the question was, so why does it matter if I vote? And he didn't address that fact, but... I guess it doesn't matter if you vote if you're voting for aliens.
Another episode.
Exactly. Yeah. You vote because you feel a civic duty to vote. It's not your fault that both of them being controlled by interdimensional reptilian overlords.
Good points.
Don't take our guns.
Question number 4. How do you tell if your sister has been taken over by aliens? My sister has been acting like a space alien.
That is the only exaggeration.
End thought.
What kind of... Is she become incredibly interested in sticking probes into you?
Unspecified.
Well, okay, so now I know
Zach,
this.
Zach, you have a sister.
Yeah. So you have to take her and all the other members of the compound and restrain them, then get them all to provide blood samples. Then you heat up the end of a wire and jab it into the blood samples.
Close.
Yeah, I think that's
and then probably, whether or not the blood reacts.
That worked well.
Is it to do with whether they float or not in water?
That is literally the best Kurt Russell movie.
That might very well be, actually.
Okay, but I think the thing is here that we obviously need to remember that ghosts are the same as extraterrestrials.
Dang it, I forgot.
The most important
thing
is, can you run through your sister? Can your sister walk through walls? Oh. And is your sister secreting a kind of ectoplasm?
Unspecified, but we'll assume yes. Then we're forced to assume yes.
That's how you tell.
Okay.
Yeah. She going, woo!
Or you can use litmus paper.
Yeah.
Or proton packs. But of course, we're all wrong. Of course, there is only one way to tell. You must take her to the movies and see where she sits. If she sits close to the screen, she's definitely an alien.
That's true. That is true.
No human being would sit close to a screen.
Because aliens have bigger eyes, they have a larger angle of view.
Is this why zoo theory exists?
Yeah.
Because there's just people sit in the front half of the theater.
Sometimes they go in. There's people at the front, and the entire back's empty. And I'm like, aliens is the only answer here.
I'm like,
and finally, lastly. How do I get the aliens to abduct me? I want to be abducted by space aliens, and I know all of the questions I want to ask them. So how do I get them to be interested in abducting and returning me? David, your thoughts?
You need to have the returning part, really. I think you need to stand nude in a cornfield, I think is evidently the way. Because the thing is, the aliens want to probe. You need to make it easy for them to probe. They might not know how to operate belts and zips, so it's probably just best to just to stand there nude in the cornfield, just hang out where they hang out.
Close. Zach.
Well, God knows that if I knew this answer, I would be here still.
You'd be returned.
Well, I wouldn't ask for the return, yeah. If science has taught me anything, surely sitting in a bowl of tinfoil would be the approach.
Both of you are actually fairly close. So the real trick of it is, what you really have to do to get the aliens to abduct me, or you in this case, is get naked.
Yeah.
So you're right on that.
Done.
Get naked.
Check.
Go up to your roof.
Yeah.
Cover yourself in Crisco.
Yeah.
Shove a pine cone up your ass. Then jump off, and if you did it right, the aliens will catch you before you hit the ground and take you to outer space.
And if you did it wrong, try again.
If at first you don't succeed, find another pine cone.
Well, I think that this was a beautiful, diverse episode. We got to talk about...
We now know where the zoo theory came from.
We got to talk about aliens, robots... and the horrible consequences of ever going to space. We're looking out for you, Robert Bigelow.
And looking out the window right now, I see a pine tree, so this will be my very last podcast.
We will see you next week, minus Dan.
Do we have any Crisco?
So I will see you next week.
I might have some of those pine cone treats for you.
And we might just have a name then. Who knows?
Who knows? So anyway.
Take care, everybody.
Bye.
Get her done.
But don't offer me a place out in cyberspace, 'cause where in the hell's that at? Now that the space race is over, it's been at its gun, and I'll never get out of my room. Now that the space race is over, I can't help but feel that we're all just going.
And then he sounded like that mouse from Star Wars.
The mouse!
Like, was that one mouse from Star Wars?
That mouse that's and then it goes, yeah! And then the mouse goes,
I bet that part sounds really good on the recording. Where you go, where it sounds like you're eating food.